Okay, I think we can begin. I think some people have probably been delayed by the rain, but the tremendous response we've had, both in writing and in person, I think indicates the importance of some of the issues that we're going to be discussing during the course of today. And let me just say very, very briefly, the purpose of our conference is to help provide a better understanding of Europe's evolution and the prospects for its further enlargement, as well as to examine what this portends for America's policy and American strategy. And I think at a time of uncertainty over the future size, shape, and effectiveness of both NATO and the EU, it is important for US policymakers and policy analysts to scrutinize closely developments in both organizations and the implications for transatlantic relations. In particular, I would say America's close allies in Central Eastern Europe have been at the forefront, and indeed are at the forefront, of building a wider Europe and a broader alliance by seeking to expand both the European Union and NATO eastwards. We need to be closely attuned, I think, to such intra-alliance debates and the impact of either inclusion or exclusion on countries, important countries such as Ukraine, Turkey, of course, as well as Moldova and Belarus, and Georgia, shouldn't forget Georgia, and others. Let me begin, though, by handing the microphone over to Zbigniew Brzeziński, who needs no introduction. Let me just say that he has been a consistent leader for many years in promoting both a broad but also an effective transatlantic community. And we are honored to have him kick off our proceedings today.
Thank you very much, Janusz. Ladies and gentlemen, I have been and am a committed believer in the notion of the American-European alliance. I think it is the vital partnership for the development of the world, for the stability of the world, for peace in the world. And that point of view, to some extent, verges on being a cliche, but not lately. Many of the most fanatic proponents of the war in Iraq have also been advocating, in effect, a very critical view of Europe and perhaps the development of some alternative alliances on the basis of opportunity or expediency, as the case may be. So the issue is not really a moot one. It does involve a matter of choice. And in addressing that issue very briefly in my introductory remarks, I would like to note that we need to really think seriously about what is Europe, where is Europe, and what kind of a Europe America needs. After all, we know where America is, and we know what America is and where it is. But we're not so clear about Europe. Only 15 years ago or so, if I were to use the word Europe, and people forget this very quickly, I would have really been talking about Western Europe. That is what Europe was in terms of our mental apparatus, in terms of our thinking. Western Europe, west of the Elbe, was Europe. Everything east of the Elbe was Eastern Europe. And west of the Elbe, that Europe which then existed, had really the potential at the time for being a Europe not only a community, but also an entity with a political definition. That is a fact, because it was a Europe in which France and Germany played politically the preeminent role. Britain was going along, but the momentum was towards not just socioeconomic and legal integration, but towards real, genuine, political, indeed, military integration. So while the notion that this was Europe was a geographical misnomer, there was a certain historical truth to the notion, this is Europe. This is the kernel of Europe that someday will be perhaps larger and more powerful, but in the meantime is developing an identity that is political, significant, not just a community. It was called the European Community. It was not called the Union. It should have been called the Union. And perhaps what we now have should be called the community. But as the case may be, the line on the Elbe disappeared. And all of a sudden, our definition of Europe changed. What was Eastern Europe from the Elbe to Vladivostok all of a sudden became differentiated. It was now Central Europe. And then east of Central Europe was Eastern Europe. And that new Central Europe wanted to be part of Europe, of that Europe which was shaping. It aspired to be part of it. And it saw its liberation as the first step in becoming part of Europe. And it was an irresistible situation, one in which no choices could really be made. It had to be part of that larger Europe. There was no way of avoiding it. It would have been a political disaster in Central Europe. It would have been self-abnegation, even in terms of Western Europe. There was a general consensus that the new Central Europe really belonged in Europe. But the obvious effect was the transformation of a new union, a proto-union, a union in the making, into, in fact, a larger community of 25 or so states. And thus we have today a Europe which is less a union and more a community, even though the official chronological and definitional process involves a shift from community to union. We have a Europe which is larger, but which finds it increasingly difficult to define itself. Does that mean that the process should therefore stop and the line should be drawn? And one should wait until this now larger community becomes a union? But is that a real choice? Is that really a real choice? To make that choice, one would have to conclude that everything east of the new Central Europe has to be indefinitely excluded. Can one exclude indefinitely Ukraine? The site of Mother Rus, of a great civilization, very much culturally a part of Europe, politically increasingly defining itself as part of Europe, and a neighbor to countries like Romania, like Poland, who definitely want Ukraine in Europe. Can that be excluded? There was at one stage the argument made that one should not even include the Baltic states because that would mean crossing a mythical red line. Have you forgotten about the red line that so many people were so worried about that we must never cross? We crossed it. The Baltic states are in NATO and in the EU. They're more prosperous for it. And the relations with Russia are more stable because of it. I think we have to ask the same questions regarding Ukraine. Belarus, in the long run, if Ukraine and Belarus become part of Europe, Russia has no choice but to be non-imperial and increasingly European. Isn't that in the interest of Europe? What about Turkey? This is obviously a more complicated problem because of religious and cultural sensitivities, but there is a historical dimension to it. The Europeans were creating a union and were serious about it, led by the French and the Germans, promised the Turks that they could be in Europe if they met the requirements of being in Europe. 40 years ago, 42 years ago to be exact, that promise was made. Those commitments were undertaken seriously. And one has to ask oneself, what are the trade-offs between Turkey becoming part of Europe with some potential admittedly complications and the negative complications of rejecting Turkey and in effect bringing the Middle East, a volatile Middle East, into Europe in part and affecting the southeastern Balkans? And beyond that, there is of course the question of countries like Georgia, which are very much part of the European civilization. So my point is that where is Europe is a geographically dynamic reality which cannot be artificially stopped. At some point it will stop itself when its outer reaches have been attained. But it is nothing that can be stopped by political fiat. It has to be part of a process. But that still leaves the question open, what is Europe? And what kind of a Europe does America need? And in many respects, in my view, America needs a Europe that is not just community, but is also a political actor. We need such a Europe. I think if on the eve of the Iraq crisis, there was such a Europe, and it spoke seriously to us, and was hesitant about some of our policies, but also willing to participate in a grand compromise and going along on a larger strategic basis with us, we would have had to listen seriously. One of the reasons we didn't listen seriously to Europe was that two European leaders, standing on their own, representing their own national politics, rejected what we wanted publicly, thereby irritating us. And one European leader came to us, whispered privately very good words of advice, but publicly endorsed everything we did or wanted to do. So we naturally pocketed the praise and the support and ignored the advice. If there had been a Europe, a union politically that was serious, I think we would have had to listen. And we needed such a Europe. Now, can we have such a Europe if where is Europe is larger and what is Europe is more difficult to define? My view is that here we have to be pragmatic and so have to be the Europeans. Namely, there is a number of European countries, 5, 6, whatever the number, which have a wider view of their role than just the attainment of self-serving interests by membership in the European community now called Union. They have foreign policy interests. And if that cluster could systematize its own activities, operate more or less as an informal process of at least concerting their collective views, then we would have something that begins to approximate the kind of a Europe that I think America needs. That is to say, a Europe that speaks seriously about its regional and even global interests in a manner that we have to take into account responsibly, because such a Europe can obstruct us, but can also support us. And that means that at our end, we have to take European interests then into account and come up jointly with an approach in which we share the decisions and the burdens. Right now, we have a situation in which we say to the Europeans, we want you to share the burdens, but we make the decisions. And the Europeans basically say to us, we want to share in the decisions, but you carry the burdens. That is basically the status quo right now, with one or two exceptions, perhaps. We need something better than that. And this is why there is a lot to be said in terms of what is Europe, where is Europe, and what kind of Europe America needs. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Zbigniew, as always. It's good to have you to kick off our proceedings, precisely the issues that we would like to consider today. I'm also happy, before we turn to our first panel, to have with us Romania's ambassador to the United States, our good friend Sorin Ducaru. Let me just say a few words about Romania. I think Romania is at the forefront, not only of seeking to construct a wider Europe, but in trying to build a strong transatlantic relationship. And I would like to personally thank Romanian institutions, especially Radio Romania, with whom we have cooperated for several years in helping in our efforts here at CSIS to foster international debate on important international issues. And I hope we will continue to host these annual, what are now annual conferences here at CSIS, also working with Romanian NGOs, including the newly established Foundation for Democracy, Culture, and Liberty. Dragoș Suliano, a good friend of mine, is here today, represents the institution, working both with government and NGOs. So without further ado, let me give the podium over to Sorin.
Thank you, Janos. And I was asked to bring a perspective on the main topic, on the wider Europe, the transatlantic link from a country that is actually in the process of becoming a full EU member, and just a year ago became a NATO member, but a country that shares a strong interest on these two key items that are today's topic, both the transatlantic link and the idea of a wider Europe. Let me start with the first. I think Romania, as other countries in Central Europe, were at a certain point perceived as countries that were needing had to choose between Europe and the United States, especially in those difficult moments where the debate over Iraq and so on became a bit heated. I want to stress that then, as now, we have been extremely powerfully stating that even before the Iron Curtain fell, we evolved as a country. We grew up as a generation, myself and the generation that I grew up with the idea that the democratic Western world is a family, and we wanted to be part of the family. And all of a sudden, when we were just at the in the moment of entering this democratic transatlantic family, there was this really very heated debate, and that tested the relationship. And at every time, we have stressed that there's no choosing between the two, and actually that our membership within the North Atlantic Alliance and within Europe will have as a key objective actually strengthening this transatlantic relationship. Is the entrance into Europe of the Central European countries changing the dynamic or the debate within EU or within NATO? I think to a certain degree it does, but not in the sense of threatening the key values, the foundation of these organizations. I would say that it strengthens them, and it gives them a broader scope and a broader area of expansion, I would say, of covering. And even while still being in a process of, I would say, strong transformation and reform to become full EU members, we are pretty much outspoken in Brussels, both at the EU headquarters and in NATO, about our interest vis-à-vis and our concerns and our ideals vis-à-vis the neighboring areas. And for two reasons. Number one, yes, there is this sense of idealism that the kind of chance and support to consolidate freedom, democracy in our country that we got from the United States, from the European Union, has to be really spread out towards our neighboring regions, the Balkans, the Western Balkans, the Black Sea area, Eastern Europe at large. It's something that one of my good friends and friends of many, Bruce Jackson, would say, spread of the frontiers of freedom. So this is idealism, but it's also a lot of self-interest, I would say. Yes, there is in our self-interest, both in Romania's or Poland's or Central European countries and Western European countries, self-interest to anchor countries like Ukraine and Turkey and those in the Western Balkans and the broader Black Sea area at this unbelievable new construction, that is the construction of the new united Europe and the, I would say, united transatlantic link. There's one particular area that I was asked to give a bit of a special focus, and this is the what we call the broader Black Sea area. Because when we speak of a wider Europe, the immediate vicinity areas, one would look would be the unfinished business, of course, in the Western Balkans, but now the eastern, let's say, border, the eastern part that neighbors European Union, which is the broader Black Sea area. I was rereading actually recently some parts of Dr. Brzezinski's book, and in terms of, if you will look to this Black Sea area in terms of the great game that he challenged us to imagine already some time ago. I would say that this area is at the intersection of three key geopolitical tectonic plates. The transatlantic democratic world, if you would imagine a map, would be like the flag of NATO or EU, the blue world on a map. The space of the former Soviet Union towards the east, and towards the south, the broader Middle East. And all these areas meet in what we call this broader Black Sea, you know, Caspian region. So the point is, if we want to reach, if we want to address this very important global issues, Middle East, you know, the evolution of the space of the former Soviet Union, with its challenges, with the opportunities, with the, you know, the role of the energy resources in that area that will very much shape the interests and the, you know, politics of the countries. We have to look to this bridge area, which is the broader Black Sea region. It is in this context that Romania, I would say, started a discussion about the future of this area and how to connect it at large to mainstream transatlantic community, and how to generate more synergy in this area and cooperation that would actually help the transformation. And I wanted to mention that there are a couple of initiatives that are already in the area, shaping the debate. You might know about the cooperation between the so-called Guam country, Georgia, Ukraine, Moldova, Azerbaijan. You might have heard about the so-called 3+3 format of cooperation between the three Baltic countries and three countries from the Black Sea, in, you know, sharing experience, both in terms of democratization, but also in terms of preparing for an eventual integration in the transatlantic mainstream. Recently, in a joint declaration, the president of Georgia and of Ukraine mentioned the idea of a community of democratic choice, which would be values-driven and would actually support cooperation among the countries in the region towards consolidated democracy and this idea of choice. And on its hand, Romania issued the idea of having a broader Black Sea forum that should actually generate a dialogue both on key political and values issues, but also on some practical areas of practical cooperation that are in the region. Last but not least, we have since the early 90s the so-called Black Sea Economic Cooperation Forum that has a strict, it's geographically defined and has a strict economic dimension. I think the key, we don't have any answers right now. And at times, one might look at as a kind of competition of initiatives and so on. What we actually are doing, especially since the spring, summer, is intensifying meetings, dialogue, coordination from the top level, at the level of presidents to the working level, in actually finding the complementarity and the essence of these things. And I think, and with this I will finish, we should look at this area like, and then the initiatives with a perception of a variable geometry in approaching it in terms of initiatives and concrete actions, based mainly on the values, not mainly or not necessary on the geography, and actually strengthen those links to connect it to what we would say mainstream transatlantic community and to the wider Europe. Thank you very much.